Zane Grey was huge. He wrote westerns. From the 1920s, Hollywood turned them into blockbuster films. He was a celebrity and a big game fisherman. That brought him to Australia in the 1930s, chasing big fish, a secret love affair, and he hoped a movie that would get him out of some financial difficulties. It would be a movie about a shark. In fact, Jaws before its time. Vicky Hastrich, fisherwoman and author, has written a new biography of the man. It's called The Last Days of Zane Grey, the untold story of a Hollywood legend in Australia and his hunt for the great white shark. I'm delighted to say that Vicky is sitting opposite me in our state-of-the-art Late Night Live studios. Vicky, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, look, you argue that fishing and writing are, in some way, similar enterprises. Please explain.
Well, David, I think the fact is that writers and fishermen are putting a line down into another realm, and we're never quite sure what's going to come up, something surprising, mercurial, beautiful. And I feel that that was a link that people don't appreciate when they think of Zane Grey and his love of fishing, that writing and fishing were two very similar enterprises for him. They certainly are for me.
I'm really convinced by this argument because there's another thing as well. Fishermen have to know what to throw back.
Ah, so true.
So true. So true. It was love of fishing that brought you to this story. And the discovery that there was a beach in Australia called Zane Grey Beach.
Well, yes, it was just a complete accident that I stumbled across this story. I was idly researching the Western as a genre, and I very soon came across the name of Zane Grey as the American writer who, if he didn't invent it, he certainly popularised it. And I'd never heard of him before, and a little further research popped up the name of the Zane Grey Caravan Park at Bermagui.
Oh, a caravan park,
yes. And I just thought, that doesn't compute. Why is a south coast town in New South Wales, why do they have a caravan park named after this writer? And that is what led me on the grand trail that has been this book.
What was it that Zane Grey brought to the Western that made his name synonymous with the Western? I mean, this was a mighty name that hardly anybody knows anymore. But what did he bring to the Western?
I think it was his mixture of romance and action.
A bit saucy and a bit violent.
Yes, definitely saucy, and that the women in his books were strong, resilient, independent women. They weren't wimps by any means. They may have ultimately needed
a bit of protection,
a hero and a protection in the end. Yeah. But they were very capable women, and so it meant that these books had a wide appeal for women and men. This combination was what made it such a hit.
I love that detail in your book that Zane Grey had told Hollywood that the filming of his books must take place in Arizona. And probably not much of the great Western expansion of the United States happened in Arizona, but that's what we think of, don't we?
We do. Those landscapes of mesa and canyon. You know, he introduced Americans to their own deserts and wild places, and of course that went global. So yes, it was a stroke of genius because they're such dramatic landscapes. And at first it was a huge impost on Hollywood. It was very rudimentary.
They had to travel.
They had to travel. And the first of his films was made in 1916. So, you know, it wasn't a well-developed industry.
Have you seen that one?
No,
a silent.
It was, yes, silent.
I presume that prints survive. I mean, they're all still there.
Yes, you know, some are missing, but that was Riders of the Purple Sage, the book that he's most famous for.
Remade in 1996?
Remade many times, five times.
Five times.
Yes, across the decades. And that's also what helped to make him so wealthy, because his bestsellers made him money. They were serialised in magazines as well. And then, of course, they were made and remade into films, each time earning him really big advances.
And then there was a brand new sport that he was a master of, a promoter of as well, big game fishing. Now, surely big game fishing has always been with us.
Oh, no. Really, it's a sport that only began around the 1910s. There was one club earlier on Santa Catalina Island in about 1897. That was the very first in the world, but very few people could participate in this sport, and it gradually expanded. But Gray was an early pioneer, and he fished in Long Key in the Florida Keys and off the coast of California, and then went further afield because he was wealthy. He could afford to turn himself into what was the world's he became known as the world's best fisherman, and way before Hemingway was known for that.
In fact, aren't there some rather grim speculations around that Hemingway copied Zane Grey?
Well,
I'd love an academic to prove that, yes.
Well, it's thought that Hemingway styled his book The Old Man and the Sea on a world record marlin that Gray caught in Tahiti, and because that was something that Gray had to wait 80, 90 days before he actually hooked that fish.
On Late Night Live, I'm talking to Vicky Hastrich, author of The Last Days of Zane Grey. Now, Vicky, everywhere he went, he brought a PR team with him. He was always news. So when he turned up in Sydney in 1936, it was an event.
It was huge. The media came down to meet the boat he arrived on, the Mariposa, and clamoured around him. Everything he said or did was news. Australians just went nuts for him. And came to his camp down in Bermagui in hundreds, in thousands even. He estimated that he signed over 5,000 photographs in the first fortnight of his arrival.
Photographs he just happened to have with him.
Yes. Well, he was rather put off by the grubby scraps of paper that were put forward to him to sign. Some people travelled hundreds of miles to just get a glimpse of him. It was almost like Beatlemania in the 60s. That's how enamoured we were with him.
And across the country at this time, his westerns were in all the pictures.
Yes, and his books, you know, they were passed around shearing sheds, and they were a kind of social currency. Everybody knew his name as well as their own prime minister.
And he was out in this country chasing fish.
Mm.
Did he catch his fish?
He did. It was part of his plan not only just to enjoy the fishing, but he wanted to capture headlines to keep his lights high and to help him do deals because, as you mentioned, his finances were shaky. But first of all, he was after swordfish, marlin, we call them more now. And then he gradually became more enamoured with the idea of bagging himself a giant great white shark.
Before we get to the sharks, just on swordfish, there's this extraordinary thing in your book that people doubted whether they were edible.
Oh, yes.
They're almost the best fish.
Oh, this was hilarious that people needed convincing, because actually a controversy lit up because the RSPCA got involved and were concerned that this was cruelty to animals and
Cruelty to Fish.
Cruelty to Fish, and they were requesting that, you know, he be sent away and this pastime should be stopped. And Zagre's riposte was to say, look, these fish are edible. There's a market for them in the US and they shouldn't be wasted. They're edible. And people were just mortified at the thought. They just, oh, no, it's not possible. So they had to, taste tests were arranged so to convince the public. It was hilarious.
But you've got no recipes in your book. Marcella Hazan has some fabulous swordfish recipes, but that's by the by. So he turned his attention to an indisputably hostile, the shark. Is the shark a fish?
Yes.
Yes. Sorry, we've arranged that the shark is a fish. And was he successful chasing sharks? It was a big tussle, was it not?
Well, initially he caught a small shark moving his camp from Bermagui to Bateman's Bay, and he had seen a huge shark underneath the boat one day, and that's what really captured his imagination. But he'd only ended up catching a small great white himself, a fish he'd never caught before. And he thought this was going to be something really worthy of his talents. And he wasn't successful catching one on his first trip to Australia, despite needing to for the film he was going to make in Hayman Island. However, he returned to Australia with that aim in mind and went to Port Lincoln in 1939. Out to those wild, remote waters to try and find the ultimate opponent, and he did.
Now, just while we're on shore for the moment, on which of his trips did he discover Lola?
Well...
And who was she?
Lola was Zane Grey's secret Australian lover. He was a man who had many lovers in his lifetime, but interestingly, they were always really long-term affairs. These women were his friends as well as his lovers, really. And his wife, Dolly, who was an amazing woman, knew all about them and tolerated them but wished this wasn't the case. She was a realist that he was never going to be faithful. And Lola had written to Zane Grey in about 1933, praising one of his books. She was an Australian poet. A middling poet who by the 30s was not well known anymore, was not being published much in the newspapers as she had once been. But she wrote praising his work. And this amazing rapport quickly built up between them. And in no time, though they'd never met, they were declaring each other, longing to meet each other. And indeed, the letters even sort of became quite racy. And then once Grey was determined to come to Australia, here was the moment when they would meet. So how would the meeting go?
Lola Gornall, we're talking about, Gornall, did they meet in Bermagui?
No, they met at the Australia Hotel.
Ah, oh, I was hoping for a Bermagui meeting at the caravan park.
Oh, no. This was on the first night Grey arrived. They met. Lola had a secret she'd been keeping from him, which was that she was, in fact, 52 years old instead of the 25 years old that he thought she would be.
Oh, the fibber! But he was not.
He was not deterred. I think she was exotic, beautiful, intelligent. He called her a genius. So he was still totally interested, and he made trips backwards and forwards from Bermagui to pursue the affair, which gradually became more and more intimate.
I hope that Lola Gornall's books are issued these days with, on the cover, a genius, Zane Grey.
Well, Lola would have loved that to have been the case, but in fact, her books were never published. She was only published in newspapers. She had a manuscript of a novel which Grey tried desperately to help her with. introducing her to his agent in the US and his publisher, but they rejected her work. The fact was she really was pretty mediocre and perhaps even outdated already.
Mediocre and outdated. Thanks, Vicky. That will really send our listeners to the work of Lola Gornal.
I'm sorry, Lola. I have a fondness for her, but her writing, I'm afraid, is not her best asset after all.
Now, let us roll forward once again to 1939 and the pursuit of the great white shark. Did he ever land a great white shark?
Well, apart from the small Bateman's Bay one, in fact, he was not able to pull in the enormous shark he actually hooked up. So this is the sort of last set piece of the book. It's his giant last adventure. And he comes face to face with, really, it's death staring him in the face. This giant great white looms up over the side of the boat, puts its head completely out of the water and he hooks this fish, but the fish beats him. And in fact, he wasn't, he was at this point a reduced man, because in between the two trips to Australia, he suffered a stroke. He turned 64 when he arrived in Australia, and then, yes, 12 months later, had a stroke by a river in Oregon. And he fought back to retain, to regain his physical strength. And he got a long way towards that, but he just wasn't the same person. So this final battle was something that was really almost beyond him. And here he was facing his mortality, really, once he stared into that great white's face.
He was a smoker and a drinker, I suppose.
He was not.
Oh.
He had signed the pledge as a young man. His mother insisted on it, and he'd never smoked. He was a very fit man, very attractive man. His wife, Dolly, said, you have easily the most magnetic personality of anyone I've ever met. And this was really interesting to me, because that wasn't the man I met on the page in his letters.
No, you find another person.
I found him to be quite restrained. There's only one hint of his humour, and that's in any marked degree, and that's an article he wrote about a shocking truck ride he had in Queensland, and that is a very nice, dry piece of writing.
Where's that? A newspaper?
In a newspaper, yeah.
Ah, Trove. Use Trove, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And find Zane Grey in an Australian newspaper.
I cannot sing the praises of Trove enough. I'm getting distracted from the other story, but Trove is... This book could not have been written without Trove, because he was so thoroughly reported on by the papers.
Of course, the publicity machine worked, and it was in all the papers.
Yes, and it meant that I could track his daily activities, almost hourly activities in some ways, and cross-reference them, because different papers carried the stories. In a way, it was like having a GPS tracker on him. That's how I have this story.
There may be some listeners who don't know what Trove is, Vicky. Tell.
Well, Trove is the digitised newspaper collection, which is hosted by the National Library of Australia. It's fully searchable. It's the most amazing resource.
It's free.
It's free. And if you're looking up somebody like I was, who has an unusual name.
Yes.
That was the big help.
It's the most beautiful one. It opens the past of this country to us, Trove.
We now have access to all these stories we could never have put together before.
Now, Vicky, this man who was so famous that, you know, squads of journalists would turn up at any wharf where he arrived. He was followed around Australia by crowds of fans and cameras, is now almost unknown. How can such fame just melt away.
It's amazing to me that he's fallen from social memory so far. But I think I'd say it was the closing of an era with his death coming in 1939, because only a few months after returning home from that fateful Port Lincoln fishing expedition, he did in fact die of a massive cardiac arrest at home. And so then, of course, war was declared, and it's very much a closing of an era then. And although his novels continued to be published posthumously for years, because he had so many manuscripts in the cupboard, his publisher had a huge stack because he really dashed them off. Yet still, I put it down to the war and everybody moving on from that, certainly in Australia.
Yeah, it was another time.
Mm.
And we had other heroes. And so Zane Grey is remembered in this country mainly by a caravan park in Bermagui. There's a nearby literary festival, a wonderful little literary festival at a place called Tathra. Now, I'm very surprised that they don't have a Zane Grey Prize, for instance, each year. I'm going to suggest it to the organisers.
That is a great idea for nature writing, because that was his greatest, I think, attribute as a writer, that he really did render landscapes beautifully and introduce people to the value of wilderness beyond what could be extracted from it.
What did he think of us in the end?
Interestingly, he held a press conference before he left Australia for the first time, and he told the reporters that he thought Australians were a very outward, forward-looking people, open, and he loved that about them. But he also told us that we did not regard or respect our Aboriginal people as we should. He had a great respect himself for Indigenous people in the US. He wrote a book called The Vanishing American, which was one of the first books in literature, American literature, to criticise public policies, government policies to do with Native Americans. That was The Vanishing American, that book, 1925, that came out. And here in Australia, he went out of his way to have interactions with Indigenous people down on the south coast of New South Wales, and again on Hayman Island when he went there to shoot the White Death movie.
How does the Native American emerge in his westerns?
He is very sympathetic towards them. I think he does feel that they're a doomed race, which is not something we would say now.
Yeah, yes. That old idea.
And that really was upsetting to him, because he could see from his own travels and experiences with Native American people, which was extensive, he could see that their connection and knowledge of the land was of a whole other order than what white people could grasp.
And yet the settlers, the pioneers, were his heroes.
Yes, yeah. I think he did feel this inevitability, that a kind of almost Darwinian philosophy.
Which was strong in Australia as well.
Yes, and it seemed like a realistic view, given the terrible treatment of these people too. How could they survive such awful disregard?
Are his books read at all today?
Well, I think it's a kind of niche interest, really, in America.
Not after people read your biography.
No, and of course some are better than others. His Riders of the Purple Sage, the classic book he's most well known for, that is came... That was on the US Library of Congress their list of 100 books that shaped America. So the Western, and was the only Western on it. So he does have this important place and will never disappear entirely for that reason.
Vicky, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, David. It's been great.
I've been talking to Vicky Hastrich, author of The Last Days of Zane Grey. Thanks.